This recording is for institutional communication use only. The views expressed represent an assessment of market conditions at a specific point in time or opinions only and should not be relied upon as investment advice regarding a particular investment or markets in general. Such information does not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell specific securities or investment vehicles. It should not be assumed that any investment will be profitable or will equal the performance of the portfolios or any securities or any sectors mentioned herein. An investor should consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the fund carefully before investing. To obtain a prospectus containing this and other information, please call 212-259-0430 or download the file from www.exoticfunds.com. Please read the prospectus carefully before you invest. Past performance does not guarantee future results. Investment returns on principal value of the fund will fluctuate so that shares may be worth more or less than their original cost. Current performance may be higher or lower than the performance data quoted above. For current performance information, please call 816-843-7623. Investing involves risk, including loss of principal. The fund is newly organized with limited operating history. The fund is classified as a non-diversified under the 1940 Act. A non-diversified fund is not limited by the 1940 Act with regard to the percentage of its assets that may be invested in the securities of a single issuer. Consequently, the securities of a particular issuer or a small number of issuers may constitute a significant portion of the fund's investment portfolio. Alps Distributors Incorporated is the distributor of the Exotic Strategic Income Fund. Exotic Capital LLC and Alps Distributors are not affiliated. Alps Distributors Incorporated is not affiliated with Exotic Funds, SkyPoint Capital Partners, or Compass Distributors. SkyPoint Capital Partners LLC serves as the wholesale marketing agent for Exotic Funds.
Greetings and welcome to the Exotic First Quarter Investor Conference Call. During the presentation, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question and answer session. At that time, if you have a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. If at any time during the conference you need to reach the operator, please press star 0. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded Wednesday, April 28, 2021. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Brian Smith. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Tina, and welcome everyone to the Exotic Strategic Income Fund quarterly call. My name is Brian Smith, CEO of SkyPoint Capital. The end of the first quarter 2021 marked the one-year anniversary of the COVID-19 pandemic. We began our partnership with Exotic Capital with the launch of the Strategic Income Fund in December of 2019. However, the fund was not approved for purchase on the various platforms until April 1st. So with $250,000 in AUM and amidst a global market meltdown, SkyPoint began to introduce many of you to what we believe to be one of the most sophisticated and highly skilled investment teams specializing in structured credit. 1 year later, the Strategic Income Fund stands at approximately $1 billion in AUM. For the first quarter 2021, the institutional share class returned 2.54% to investors. And over the previous two quarters, the Exotic Strategic Income Fund has outperformed its benchmark, the Bloomberg Barclay Aggregate Bond Index, by over 6%. And now on to our speakers. Founder Clay DiGiacinto serves as a managing partner and CIO for Exotic. Prior to forming the firm, Clay served as the vice president in the fixed income currency and commodities group at Goldman Sachs and Company, and is the head of mortgage trading for Tower Research Capital. Clay received a degree in mechanical engineering from the U.S. Military Academy at West Point and his MBA in finance and statistics from the Wharton School of Business. Clay also served as captain in the U.S. Army in the 25th Infantry Division from 1995 to 2000. Peter Cicchini currently serves as Exotic Capital's director of research and head of macro strategy. Formerly, he was the founder and chief strategist at Alpha Omega Advisors, an independent research and consulting firm. Prior to that, Peter was Candor's global chief marketing strategist, as well as head of cross-asset strategy. Peter speaks routinely at conferences and appears on various media outlets. Peter holds an MBA from Columbia University, a JD from Boston University School of Law, and a BA in economics from Haverford College. With that, I will now turn the call over to Clay.
Thanks, Brian, and thank you, everybody, for joining. It is interesting to look back 1 year after the pandemic. It's been quite an investable environment, and I think one of the main things that we learned from the past 12 months is that fundamentals work, cash flows work. And any time we marry some sort of technical stress in the market and we're emboldened in our fundamentally biased research that the cash flows will actually pay us back what we invested and then a lot more over time, it serves as a wonderful buying opportunity. So we were able to take advantage. You know, thankfully, the money came in at the time where there was massive technical distress in the market, and we put this money to work in cash flows that we had a high degree of confidence around. So we're very happy with our 12-month performance, and we still have this view that cash flows work, and we're excited to invest the remaining cash as well as any other investments that we get into fundamentally sound assets where we can create an above-market return for the risk that we're taking. Exonic's stronger than ever. We're at our high watermark from an AUM perspective, right at $3.9 billion. We have 53 professionals at the firm. That includes 18 investment professionals. And we're still focusing on broad-based structured credit. So RMBS, CMBS, asset-backed securities, corporate opportunistic if it's sort of balance sheet biased, and aviation ABS, et cetera. I am very pleased to introduce Pete Ciccini to our call today. We've added Pete Ciccini to the Axonic team to serve as our director of research. I've been following Pete's career for the past 10 years and admiring his views on the world and macro calls. He has a great sense of the bigger picture, and has previously served as the chief strategist at Cantor, focusing on cross assets. So that's important because the interconnectedness of how the certain macroeconomic backdrop is on the margin positively or negatively impacts certain sectors or specific names. We at Axonic have and always will be a fundamentally biased, bottoms-up approach. We'll use a fundamentally biased, bottoms-up approach to our selection of cash flows. That's not going to change. But I do think we're at a paradigm shift in macroeconomic policy, and I'm more convinced than ever that there will be more interconnectedness to asset classes based on policy or econometric shifts in data. We think this backdrop will be more important over the next 5 years than the previous 5 years, and at Axonic, we're trying to run to where the ball is going. I'm truly humbled that Pete's chosen Axonic for the next phase of his career, and I know he'll be accretive to our investment process over time. Axonic's not going to turn into a macro shop, I'll tell you that. But my hope is to be ahead of the curve as macro events shape the periphery of the structured credit market. And as competitive as this market is, we're excited to have another leg up. So now I'd like to turn it over to Pete to talk through our slides to present today.
Thanks, Clay, and thanks everyone for joining. And I want to say that I appreciate those kind words, Clay. And you know, the admiration is clearly mutual. I've known Clay for a number of years, and one of the things that was clear to me is he is an incredibly principled individual, going beyond the investment talent that he obviously possesses, which is evident in the fact that he's built such a successful organization. He's a principled man, and as a steward of capital, is certainly somebody that I would trust for certain. And in this last stage of my career, I'm betting on what I think is going to be a very good partnership going forward. A bit about my background in terms of how it does fit with the firm. When I came out of business school, I was on the buy side for 10 years. I focused on credit and distressed, and the bottoms-up fundamental approach of the firm is philosophically consistent with the way I think about the world. And I hope to bring an overlay relative to the very successful philosophy and approach that the firm has already employed that will hopefully give us a bit of an edge in a world that is changing. So perhaps that's a good way to start. It is a very unusual time in markets, and, people speak about paradigm shifts all the time. But and it's an overused term, but truly now at zero interest rate policy, there has been a paradigmatic shift in the rates environment. And obviously, rates are a very important part of the the credit backdrop for an asset management platform. I think I'll start with the sort of the conclusion or the punchline here, and say that, you know, we have a rates view, and we believe rates may rise to, you know, 2.5% or so on inflation and treasury supply. And I think that's important to the way we're thinking about the portfolio, because it may suggest a shorter duration lean. In addition, the corporate credit cycle was already fragile coming into the pandemic, and frankly remains so, absent the stimulus, because of the excessive leverage inherent in U.S. corporate balance sheets right now. In contrast, though, the consumer has remained relatively strong, and for that reason, we do believe multifamily cash flows should also remain strong and a place that will be good to invest for some time on in the future. So I think I'll start with the first slide, and this idea that we've come to the end of a 35-plus year trend, secular downtrend in interest rates. And what this chart displays is the 10-year yield, which is orange, banded by a regression, with the regression prediction in the middle in sort of light blue, banded by 1 and 2 standard deviations in yellow and red. And the reason why that's interesting, and in addition, I want to point out we also have the federal funds target rate, which is the black dotted line, as well as the Fed's balance sheet, which is the blue bars. And I think, you know, what's interesting overall here is that the 2 standard deviation level on 10-year yields has served as something of a harbinger for volatility in both the corporate credit and equity markets. And we could see that in 2000, we could see that in 2007, and in fact we saw that most recently in 2018, when, if you recall, the Fed sort of stubbornly communicated in its meeting in December of 2018 that it was on the path to continue to normalize the balance sheet, which effectively led to something of a taper tantrum, an inversion in the yield curve, and the need for the Fed to quickly cut rates in what, frankly, was already something of a weakening macroeconomic environment. What this also shows, I think, bigger picture, is that the Fed's ability to affect macroeconomic outcomes is waning as we approach the zero bound. That is to say, the Fed's policy does not work through some quantity of money phenomenon, as I think some mistakenly believe is a vestige of Milton Friedman's famous phrase, but rather it works through interest rates. And when rates and yields approach zero, no matter how many reserves the Fed creates to buy treasuries vis-a-vis QE, when yields are near zero, its ability to stimulate the real economy and to goose asset prices becomes more and more limited. And for that reason, fiscal stimulus has become more and more important, which takes us to the next slide. The next slide shows the importance of fiscal deficits. And the Fed's role now has changed from, again, one in which it was able to affect macroeconomic policy outcomes relatively effectively to one in which it is now really monetizing, sort of as a knave, if you will, of physical policy. It's now monetizing massive treasury issuance. And what these two charts show you, the top chart shows the U.S. deficit as a percent of GDP, which far outstrips even what we saw during the great financial crisis. And the lower chart shows you the difference between what the Fed is buying and what is required with deficits. And it shows you that there's quite a shortfall. And that's important because all of that is baked into what the future path of interest rates is going to be. Because unlike in previous cycles, the Fed is now in control of the entire curve, not just the short end through temporary open market operations, but also on the long end through what it calls permanent open market operations, and that's really large-scale asset purchases and quantitative easing. And what we see here is that, again, the supply of treasuries is likely to far outstrip the Fed, which means that either outside participants will need to buy treasury supply or the Fed will need to step up and twist. For that reason, we believe that the bias for the 10-year yield and for bond yields will be somewhat higher, probably to the top end of that regression trend, which is about 2.25 to 2.5. So at least in the near term, the shorter duration bias seems prudent. Now we can talk a little bit perhaps about, you know, where we are in the cycle and why we like multifamily. And I think the next chart speaks to that quite well, and particularly on a relative basis. The consumer is in very good shape relative to both history and relative to where the consumer was just, you know, a year ago. And we can see that the debt service coverage ratio for the consumer, which is in blue, is below the historical average, and the consumer once again has access to the loan market, and I used consumer installment loans as a proxy for that access. So we're confident that the consumer remains solid, and that, again, that should favor multi-cap cash flows. In addition, on the next slide, we wanted to just take a quick look at the valuation piece of the puzzle relative to where we are in the economic cycle. And I apologize for the chart being a little bit busy, but it is actually somewhat easy to explain. In the lower panel, we simply see the U.S. yield curve as represented by the spread between the 10-year and the 2-year. When the yield curve inverts, you can see that 210 spread. Those bars go below the zero line. And that typically is followed by a recession and or market volatility somewhere between with a 3 and 18-month lag. The top chart shows the trend in the 10-year, which is the more squiggly, I believe it's an orange line, and multifam cap rates, which are the blue line. Now, importantly, we can see that after recessions, cap rates will often tend to rise. And we saw that after the 80 recession, after the 2000 recession, or after the 90 recession, not quite as much after the 2000 recession. And it's important to note that because that was really a corporate-driven recession, not a consumer-driven recession. And we think that any economic slowdown that's likely to occur on a go-forward basis is likely to be driven by corporate leverage rather than by any problems that the consumer might have. That might also suggest that assets that are related to corporations, both credit and equity, will suffer relatively more than assets that are related to the strength of the consumer as multifam might be. The one caveat there I will say before I conclude is that the Fed does not have a lot of room to do what it did, that is to cut interest rates like it did in 2000. And for that reason, it's going to be very important to be aware of where monetary and fiscal policy go next. Fed is constrained, and fiscal policy is what we're going to be focused on to a large degree on a go-forward basis.
Thanks, Peter. That's great. I'm sure our investors got a good sort of sense into what we're thinking and appreciate your thoughts and look forward to them continuing on our calls. It should come as no surprise that our firm stance on rates informs our view of constructing a portfolio. And as of March 31st, the rate duration of our portfolio was sub 1.5 years. That's a function of two things. Number one, about 40% of the portfolio is in floating rate assets or indexed to LIBOR. And two, our fixed rate assets are relatively short. We're focused on cash flows where we never want the tail wagging the dog, or we try to limit the tail wagging the dog, because we don't want our focus on cash flows to be dominated by significant change in price due to something that we can't control. So the rate component of this, we try to keep short and continue to focus on the cash flows, which has served us well. The other thing that I thought was really interesting, and I looked at the trade blotter last night, Our fund is approaching $1 billion. We continue to raise assets. I think, you know, every week the AUM has gone up from new investors coming in. But I told you all from the beginning that this was not going to be a buy it and forget it fund. I sort of scratch my head when people can put, you know, billions of dollars to work in a buy it and forget it strategy, because the fact is our cash flows are dynamic. We're looking at structured credit assets. We think where in the capital structure we want to be, but we're always focusing our research on the loan side or the liability side of that equation. Where are these cash flows coming from? And every month, a few of the loans prepay, a few of the loans default, a few of the loans have gone to REO, a few of the loans may be in some sort of forbearance, and that is effectively what we're trying to re-underwrite every single month in our very robust surveillance and maintenance process. So the outcome of that is, even though we've been raising assets every week, over the past 6 months, we've actually sold $181 million of securities. Because it didn't make sense for us to hold these at where the price was. On average, this was up about 5 points. On average, that's about 13.5% increase or sort of gain on sale because of that sell. But here's the most interesting sort of statistic. In all of that $181 million, or in all of these bonds that we bought and sold, one of them we bought above par. By the way, there's 52 securities. One of them we bought above par. 27 of them we sold above par. So that goes back to this negative convexity associated with structured credit markets. These assets can go down a lot more and a lot faster than they can go up. And when something is appreciated in our mind to par or above par, be it a little or a lot, it may make sense to go ahead and sell, take the gain, and, you know, especially if we can redeploy into other assets that are below par that we just think have a much more interesting convexity profile, a consistent surveillance and maintenance process where we re-underwrite all of our cash flows on a monthly basis. And that's what informs our decision to buy and to sell. Going back to the portfolio, nothing has changed significantly on the RMBS side. We still like the legacy RMBS part of the capital structure. Again, going to the convexity component, we love the legacy bonds because there's some call option there's some call optionality, meaning that the servicer can collapse these mortgage securitization trusts and basically turn bonds back into loans. So if we can find specific CUSIPs or specific bonds where we think the collateral pool is more likely than not or more likely than others or more likely than the average collateral pool to be called or collapsed by the servicer, that's a cash flow that we want to buy because we're buying it below par and our downside is a mid-single digits yield to maturity. But our upside can be double digits when these assets get called. So that's a trade that we've liked for a long time, and we continue to like it. I guess moving to CMBS a little bit, Peter mentioned our bias towards multifamily. We like multifamily. We also like single family on the RMBS side. I mean, the fact is it's really interesting to be, and we're quite fortunate to be investing in a sector where there's a systematic shortage of housing throughout the country. I'm sure you guys are seeing it just as we are, you know, at least I hear about it in other states, Texas, Georgia, Florida, Colorado, Arizona. You know, there are very few homes that are trading at ask, and the average now is trading above ask. That's a consistent theme that we've seen, we've read, we've done the research on across the board. I will tell you, being based here in Midtown Manhattan, that is not the case in Manhattan. But to all those other states and geographies, we continue to expect that bullish theme. Our CMBS portfolio, which is about 35% of the fund, 50% remains in that multifamily sector. We have a wonderful relationship with Freddie Mac. We've been participants and advisors and risk share buyers of their small balance multifamily program. We actually helped them create this program back in sort of 2014-15, and we continue to have the dominant market share of effectively their risk share piece on their multifamily portfolio. So just spending 30 seconds on this, Freddie entered the small balance multifamily lending market. That represents loans between, call it, $2 and $10 million, geographically dispersed, garden-style, low-rise apartments all throughout the country. The pressure from them was both from their regulator as well as Congress to establish or try to continue to promote affordable housing. So in general, these are Class B-type assets, and we love this asset class for all of the reasons that you can imagine. We think it's a very defensive sector, meaning that there's always a bid for Class B. If you're in Class A, you know, spending, you know, $2,500 a month and something happens in your life, you can always downsize to the $1,200 a month Class B. And then there's a whole you know, swath of folks that are trying to upgrade their life and get into something more than manufactured housing or Class C. And so there continues to be a bid for that Class B. Over the past 12 months, we've seen occupancies go down and rent rates in the sector go up. So that sort of qualifies our opinion that we've had over the past 5 years. That's 50% of our CMBS portfolio. The balance tends to be low loan count, legacy mezz. CMBS, where resi is the law of large numbers, and CMBS, there can be few or fewer specific loans to look at. When there's 100 loans, it gets hard to wrap your head around what is going to affect the outcome. But when there's low loan counts, we can actually wrap our head around it very well. So it's sort of it's low loan count, so it's at the end of its tenure. Also sort of promoting the duration that we're looking for. So these are low loan count CMBS mezz, call it sort of high-ish 90s dollar price, 1 to 2 years weighted average life, and a 6% coupon, which we think fits the access book very well. We've also been big investors in the ABS sector and specifically on the aviation side, aviation ABS. Prices have gone up. We've, you know, where others shied away from this, we actually thought it became a really interesting asset class. If you've been on previous calls that we've had, I sort of thought about this akin to what subprime looked like in 2009, meaning this is scenario-based, and we could have very conservative scenarios on the return of planes into service, on how airlines would deal with lease payments on their airplanes, et cetera. We could have very conservative assumptions and still run this at a significant sort of mid-teens type yield. And that's, you know, those are sort of the things that that folks like us dream about when we can get our hands on that. So we did. That thesis is also proven out. We still think that it's an interesting and mispriced asset class. It represents aviation ABS in particular represents about 15% of access today. The new issue market is open back up, and as I'm sure everybody's aware, there you know we think there's pent up demand for not only leisure travel, but you know we think that business is going to come back as well. We're about 12% cash, which I think feels reasonable. We're okay to take that cash number down. Again, we expect to continue to grow this fund, but it's going to be opportunistically driven. So one of the things that that hopefully you've understood when you invest with us is that we're not going to park cash in something low yielding just so that we can say we're fully invested. The skew doesn't make sense. So could we park cash in something that makes us, you know, 2.5-3% annually? We can, or we could. But the downside on that or the negative convexity associated with parking cash there, we don't think makes a lot of sense. So we'd rather have cash available and at the ready to deploy in scenarios when they present themselves, and they do. What I will tell you about structured credit, and this has been,
you know, this way for 20 years is anywhere in the structured credit market, there is some sort of distress opportunity, and there always tends to be something interesting to invest in. We saw it even over this past quarter end, March 31st, where there was significant de-risking by dealer balance sheets, and that turned out to be a pretty opportune time to buy. There was some softness in the market in late March, and we were able to take advantage of that by having a larger cash buffer than otherwise, and deployed those assets, or deployed the cash, and then saw it catch a little bit of a bid in April. So I guess with that, Brian, I'll turn it back over to you.
Great. Tina, can we open up the phone lines for questions, please?
My pleasure. Via the phone lines, if you would like to register a question or comment, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. You will hear a 3-tone prompt to acknowledge your request. If your question has been answered and you would like to withdraw your registration, please press the 1 followed by the 3. One moment, please, for our first question. The first question comes from Travis Weaver. Please go ahead.
Hey, can you expand on how does the mutual fund actually get a certain deal versus your other investment opportunities?
As it relates to where do bonds go, we have a algorithmic allocation process where when a PM buys a specific bond, it algorithmically gets allocated to the fund that needs it. And in general, the daily fund or this 40 Act fund would get a higher percentage of higher grade assets that we invest in.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. As a reminder, via the phone lines, you may press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone keypad to register a question or comment. The 1-4.
Great. Clay, could you just, in case somebody wants to ask one more question, I just wanted you, could you just comment on kind of the view of this real estate market on the residential side? We've seen some significant price appreciation in some key markets. And what is the overall effect there on the RMBS market that you all see?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The home price appreciation that we've seen over the past 12 months certainly wasn't what we expected. It far and away surpassed the appreciation that we would have predicted if we rewound the clock 12 months ago. But you know, we do know that there remains a systemic shortage. You know, I've read a lot on what's sort of causing this most recent cycle, you know, more cash in more people's hands. I also think there's a demographic trend that a lot of the Gen Zers, I guess, right? Is that the millennials? A lot of the millennials that were cooped up in their parents' basement or what have you in very small apartments are now going out and buying their first-time homes. That's where you're seeing the most appreciation, we think. But it's interesting. And although we didn't predict it, we've always prepared ourselves to by forming our allocation to the RMBS sector in discount bonds. You know, I mentioned we'd sold 27 bonds out of the 52 that we sold were all of them that were above par. Our RMBS portfolio, although I don't have the weighted average price on right now available, but it's certainly sub 90. So any event that causes a higher amount of refis or a higher amount of callability of collateral, that's constructive to our RMBS portfolio, and that's we have had full intent to be able to take advantage of that, and higher prepayments due to higher prices overall will benefit the way that we're positioned.
Great, thank you, operator. Are there any further questions?
We do. We have a question from the line of Naj Kazim. Please go ahead.
Yes. Hi. How are you guys? Thank you for your time today. Earlier, you guys were talking about within the RMBS, you were favored toward legacy part of the capital structure. I didn't understand when you were talking about collapsing the servicer side, where the servicer would collapse the pool into a bond. What's happening there?
Yeah, so it's interesting. This is a little bit of a technicality, and you know, we've always, we've sort of thought that the structured credit market is really interesting for alpha focused investors, and that for beta focused investors, or you know, we sort of call them tourists, just people that are buying the asset class as a whole, they're going to miss a lot of these nuances. There is some terminology in legacy RMBS that we like and appreciate, and it remains our biggest holding here at the firm in the resi sector, where deals pre-2008 have a feature in their pooling and servicing agreement or the trust's agreement with the servicer that a few things have to happen. Number one, if the deal factor is less than 10%, so if it's originally a billion-dollar deal, there needs to be $100 million or less outstanding of collateral. Two is, if a servicer that has the disposition and propensity to collapse the deal, meaning sort of the willingness and ableness to collapse the deal, we have a pretty sophisticated system that gives us intel on that servicer's propensity and willingness and ability to collapse, meaning that they can do it. Which is something that we track. But the most important part of this this construct is that the pool of collateral, meaning all of the loans, are above par. So that would make the servicer see this as an economically viable transaction to make. So servicer would effectively pay off all bonds or pay down the bonds at par. What they get, what they receive when they pay off all the bonds at par is they get the pool of loans. So they'll do that if the pool of loans is worth more than par. The reason it's worth more than par, the reason it can be worth more than par is, number one, they tend to be higher coupon loans. So, you know, loans in the high fours, 5-6%, believe it or not, are still outstanding. And those are very, very valuable loans because that loan has, number one, been current for 13 years, but it also hasn't refied in 13 years. It hasn't taken advantage of all of these refinance cycles that we've had. So a servicer or that loan becomes much more valuable than par, 102, 103, 104, maybe even 105. And the servicers trying to, or some servicers will try to arbitrage that difference by paying off bondholders at par. Obviously, we own them at 90, and then they'll receive the loans that are worth a lot more than par. One other nuance, and it's interesting from a structure perspective, we always say that, you know, that we get to enjoy one thing or a couple things by investing in the structured credit landscape. One is the complexity of the pool. There are many risk factors that go into our determining what we think on a go-forward basis the prepayment curve, default curve, forbearance curve, and recovery curve will look like by the loan level and all of the underlying assets that we have. But two is, we get to enjoy the complexity of securitization. And there are plenty of either timing pay rules or credit pay rules within a securitization, and we're always looking for which bond, which CUSIP within a specific securitization gives us the most bang for our buck. Or, you know, it doesn't always mean that the junior one, doesn't always mean the senior one. It completely depends on the pool of collateral that's associated with. So even though I say that the pool factor of the collateral needs to be 10% of its original, that doesn't mean that the bond has amortized to be 10% of its original face. There are plenty of bonds that we own that are actually still have all of their original face, even though the deal factor is less than 10%. And this is a function of pay rules established 12 years ago and the fact that some of them triggered during the last crisis so that some of the mezzanine or subordinate bonds won't get paid until all of the seniors are paid. So that bond, original principal balance of $10 million may still be $10 million. So this, it's an exciting part of the market that we've been in. You know, I This is an old trick from Goldman that I learned way back when. My partner who runs our RMBS business and co-head of credit is Jamshed Engineer. He was a structurer at Goldman for a long time and really focuses in on the specific pay rules and what is and isn't allowed as it relates to the servicer ability and responsibility to collapse the trust. This was, last thing, I know it's a long-winded answer. This was originally done to clean up line items so that servicers didn't have, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 deals outstanding. When the deal became small enough, they could collapse it. They could collapse 10 deals and basically re-securitize it and turn it into one. It just sort of, it was almost made as an ease of use or cleanup of a line item perspective. Collapse trusts, because trusts that are low loan balance collateral compared to what it originally was, tend to be expensive for the servicer to maintain. So that's what it was originally created for. We've sort of seen it as an interesting convex investment opportunity.
Thank you. No, this is very helpful.
Great. I know we're coming up on 45 minutes here. We did have one mail-in question. So let me read that to you very quickly, Clay. I think the first part is, what is the proportion of the portfolio in CMBS, and what opportunities, concerns do you see in the space right now?
Sure. Right now, the CMBS position in the Axis Fund is about 42% of market value. I mentioned that most of that is in the multifamily space or bonds backed by that partnership with Freddie Mac. Some of it is in SASB, single asset, single borrower deals. We've mentioned on this call, and not to overemphasize it, but when your credit investors like we are, we don't focus on the average and standard deviation of specific credit attributes. We don't think about the average credit score or the average NOI or the average debt service or the average occupancy. We actually try to just stress the left tail. And that specifically is why we never got involved in new issue, straight down the middle conduit, mezz, or credit pieces. We've been a wonderful partner with Freddie on their B pieces. We love agency B pieces. We've never bought in the history of our firm a conduit B piece. And that's a real dichotomy of the way that we think about investing versus the field. I would tell you that I could not imagine another investor has that view. They're either a B-piece buyer and they like all B-piece buyer purchases, or they're not a B-piece buyer and they don't do any. We do GSE B-pieces. We don't do conduit B-pieces. And the reason is because we can't get comfortable with the left tail of those assets. But we can get comfortable with SASB. SASB stands for single asset, single borrower. It's underwriting the credit attributes of one or a handful of interconnected and associated loans. And then we pick where in the capital structure that tends to be most interesting. So about for the Axis Fund, about 40% of the 42% or 52%, so call it about 40% of the 42%, or about 17%, is in SASB. That would be mainly office SASB, and it's higher up in the capital structure. So these are bonds that all day in our stress cases will pay off at par. They're relatively short duration. There's some sort of refinance opportunity on the horizon, and we own those with an average dollar price around, call it low 90s, 90, 91, 92, 93. So they're par assets. We don't consider them to be specific around credit events. And then I mentioned lastly that last 10% would be the low loan count legacy mezz. And again, going back to this sort of tail of distributions, low loan count means that a lot of the loans in the portfolio have either refinanced, completely defaulted. It doesn't matter how they got out, but they're out of the pool. So the number of loans in the pool, we can actually stress the left tail on. And again, these are not credit assets. We have not seen – we've stressed them and made sure that they're par in our bear case. So these are, call it higher dollar price 90s, you know, sort of 95 to 99, tend to be high coupon and very low duration, so sort of 1 to 2 years of duration. So our expectation there is not that, again, the tail wags the dog. If cap rates go out or if yields blow out 100, 200 basis points, these are so low duration that what we're going to get is our 6% coupon paid monthly, right? So we'll get 50 basis points monthly on that coupon, and then we're, you know, 99% confident we're going to get paid off at par in the next year or two.
Great. Thank you for that.
I think maybe your question was, what worries me? We're positioning this fund so that, you know, I can sleep at night, and so hopefully you guys can sleep at night, because there's a lot of things that made me stay awake. The assets that we select for this fund are not necessarily one of them.
Great, thank you. Well, I think that should wrap it up. I wanted to thank everyone for their attendance today. Clay and Pete, thank you very much. Insightful as always. We look forward to next quarter's call and wish everybody the best. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. This does conclude the conference call for today. We thank you for your participation and ask that you please disconnect your lines. Thank you and have a good day.